Canto 10, chapter 27, text 11. Swachando pata dehaya. Swachando pata dehaya. Swachando pata dehaya. Vishuddha Jnana Murtaye, Vishuddha Jnana Murtaye, Sarvasmai Sarva Bijaya, Sarvasmai Sarva Bijaya. Sarva Bhutatmane Namah. Sva, of his own devotees. Chanda, according to the desire. Upata, who assumes Dehaya, his transcendental bodies. Vishuddha, perfectly pure. Jnana, knowledge. Murtaye, whose form. Sarvasmai, unto him who is everything. Sarva Bijaya, who is the seed of all. Sarva Bhuta, of all created beings. Atmane, who is the indwelling soul. Namaha, obeisances. Unto him who assumes transcendental bodies according to the desires of his devotees. Unto him whose form is itself pure consciousness. Unto him who is everything, who is the seed of everything, and who is the soul of all creatures. I offer my obeisances. Please repeat. Unto him who assumes transcendental bodies, according to the desires of his devotees. Unto him whose form is itself pure consciousness. Unto him who is everything. Who is the seed of everything. And who is the soul of all creatures. I offer my obeisances. Purport. We could hardly construe from the first line of this verse that God is somehow impersonal, but assumes a personal material body. It is clearly said here that the Lord assumes different forms according to swachanda, or according to his own desire, or according to the desires of his devotees. An impersonal God could hardly reciprocate with the personal desires of its devotees. And nor could an impersonal God itself have desires, since desire is characteristic of personality. Therefore, the Lord's manifesting different forms in a personal way, responding to personal desires, indicates that he is eternally a person and manifests his different transcendental bodies as an expression of his own eternal nature. The word Vishuddha Jnana Murtaye is most significant. Murti means the form of the deity, and it is specifically stated here that the Lord's form is itself completely pure consciousness. Consciousness is the primary spiritual element. It is distinct from any of the material elements, and even distinct from the subtle or psychological material elements, mundane, mind, intellect, and false ego, which are simply a psychic covering over pure consciousness. Since the Lord's form is made of pure consciousness, it can hardly be understood as a material body like the mortal bags of flesh and bones that we carry around in this world. In the last two lines of this verse, there is poetic emphasis on the word sarva, which means everything. The Lord is everything. He is the seed of everything, and He is the soul of every creature. Therefore, let us join with Indra in offering our obeisances to the Lord. Now this and the next two verses, I think, are the end of Indra's prayers. And so now at this particular point, he's actually, this verse and the last verse, the tenth verse, are his obeisances. And the last two verses is he's going to speak a little personally more, because if there's an interesting format for offering prayers, that if you look in some of these situations, you can see they begin with some degree of glorification of the person who you are praying to, and then you state your required goal while you were expressing this, then you offer obeisances to them. And then there is some sort of personal putting yourself in a humble position. They're great, you're humble, offer obeisances. And somewhere in the prayer there is a seeking of a blessing, because you've gone to ask for something in these prayers. And of course, a pure person, when they're asking for something, they're asking for something pure. And a person who has some personal motivation in their prayer, they'll ask for that. When we were teaching young boys in Gurukul in Hitanagari, we had made a little kind of a formula that we would, when it was time for Janmashtami or Gopunim, we'd bring out this little board, and it had 4 points. You do these four things when you're offering prayers. You offer your obeisances, you glorify the person, you present yourself, and you ask for something. And recently somewhere I read or heard that Srila Prabhupada said that when you offer prayers, you must ask for something. So I would tell them that you must ask for something. And then it was an interesting character experience to see their character, what they asked for. Because some of them were so simple, even as young children, some of them would think, what am I supposed to ask for here? And they would ask for something kind of, please give me pure devotional service. But a little child asking like this, it was clearly what they were supposed to ask for. But some of them were more spontaneous, and when you got to the asking, they would have enormous request lists. And it was quite humorous. Some of them would really imagine off there, and they wanted, 10 bicycles, and they wanted to go on holidays all year, and they wanted this and they wanted that. And so the idea of the exercise was to say to them, offer whatever you can imagine what you would like to offer. So they would imagine wonderful things to offer. It gave them more scope for offering. But then, of course, they would turn that around the other way and imagine what they would like to ask for. So their imagination was quite vivid. But here, Indra has also, he has said what he wants. He has said that punishing me won't work because of my nature. It just won't really work so well. So therefore, please, instead of punishing me, give me your mercy. So he's very clever. He's worked out because of his... He's such a powerful man, so how could he not be clever? And then in this verse 10 and 11, when we read today, he's offering his obeisances. There's the Namas Tubhyam Bhagavate, and this one finishes with this word Namaha. Both finish with the word Namaha. So we say Namah Om Vishnu Padaya, offering obeisances. So he's offering his obeisances to Krishna. And as is spoken here by the acharyas and presented in the purport, he finishes the second half of this verse. You can see there's one word used a lot, which is sarva. Sarvasmai Sarva Vijaya Sarva Bhutatmane Namaha. He finishes with his offering of obeisances in this way. So this word sarva means, as we all know, all. Does anyone know where that word also comes in? Where you've heard that word sarva? Any verses? Again. Sabadamam Pruchaja. Sarva Yonisho Kunteya. Sarvasya Chaham. Aham Sarvasya Prabhu. So many, many, many places this word Sarvasya or all comes. So Sarva Dharma means all religions. Parichaja, all your dharmas, all your duties and obligations in this world, give them up. And Krishna is saying also, I am Sarva Bhutanam. I am the father. Sarva Yonishu. What is that? I place them in all the different wombs. And so on and so forth. Krishna is using this word a lot, all. We can't use this word all so freely on our own account. We can't say that all the people in Melbourne should surrender to me. All of this should happen to me. When we draw it to ourselves, we can only ask for a small relative quantity of mercy or power or control or whatever. But Krishna, this word sarva, all, comes in very freely. And I was quite taken in reading this translation. What is he all? You are the seed of everyone. You are everything. Krishna, he's saying, you are everything. And you are the seed of everything. So why would you want to say, if you say you're everything and you're the seed of everything, why do you say, isn't it repetitive to be the seed of everything? If he's everything.
Because he's the root cause.
But that's included in everything. Can anyone think of a significant reason why the seed of everything should be included? Yes? There we go, the same point. The Achintya Veda Veda Tattva. He is everything, but he's the cause of everything. So this is this inconceivable. If everything is in this room, that means everything. By logic, everything is in this room. And if everything, if he's here, but he's not here, then this is inconceivable. This is the Achintya Veda Veda Tattva. He's the seed of everything, and he is everything. He is simultaneously the creator of everything, cause of everything, and he is. And Sarva Bhutatmane, which is that he is the soul of all creatures. I once found myself meditating on some verse in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, Prithu Maharaja's prayers, and thinking how much easier it would be to appreciate others if you could actually understand that their path, they're actually literally, it's actually Krishna. Not in the, here again we have the Achintya Veda, Aveda Tattva, but they're part of him. That means they're not different than him. And it's very, very difficult to see like this. And you can see that when we meet, which we have had the good fortune either directly or through the pages of his presentation of the Bhagavatam, when you meet somebody who sees like that, it's most extraordinary. It transcends any other extraordinary experience that you could have. You can meet powerful people, influential people, and whoever you meet that has some shakti, it's attractive, because this power of some kind, it draws the attention of everyone. But to meet somebody who sees Krishna equally in everyone, it means there's an equality in their vision and their dealings. And it's not just something they've been told to do, but it's something that is completely natural for them. And it's quite extraordinary. We hear that the six Goswamis had this quality, dira adira. They were equally kind to the ruffians as to the cultured. They didn't discriminate, this is this and this is this. So this is the Uttam Bhagavat platform, Uttam Adhikari platform. You can see Krishna in everyone. For us, We have to hear how Krishna is in everyone, and gradually by our application of spiritual practice, we hope that this will become somehow or other, in some distant lifetime maybe, but it will become ours to be able to see in this way also. So now I would like to go on a little bit to after this, Indra has offered his obeisances. The next verse, Indra is going to speak a little bit honestly, because in this prayer he has offered everything, he's paid his respects, but Indra may be still not quite sure whether or not Krishna has what he's going to do. Because it is still him speaking, and Krishna hasn't replied to him yet. So in Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's comments on the next verse, which goes like this: "My dear Lord, when my sacrifice was disrupted, I became fiercely angry because of false pride. And thus I tried to destroy your cowherd community with severe rain and wind." So this is a quite open admission of what he did after being very clever in his language and saying, I became a little overwhelmed and so on and so forth, and please give me your mercy, and here's my obeisances, you're everything, you're so great. And now he's actually speaking. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that Krishna might have replied to Indra in this verse by saying, "Oh Indra, I can understand from your recitation of all my praises," which he has just given in this verse that we read this morning and the previous one, "that you are my devotee." So he's accepted him. He's not considering him neutral. He said, "No, you are my devotee. But without your sanction, these wicked Sampantaka clouds attacked my Vraj. So you should punish them." And Krishna is thinking he might reply like this. In other words, he's offering such beautiful prayers and he's speaking so nicely that Krishna may a little sarcastically say to him, "Ah, I can see that you wouldn't do anything horrible. You're such a nice person. But your clouds did. So you should give them some words of advice on their misbehavior." So fearing such an innocent scolding from Krishna, which of course isn't exactly an innocent scolding, Indra thought, "I cannot be duplicitous with the all-knowing Supersoul. Therefore, in this next verse, verse 13, Indra decided to confess that everything was actually his fault. Krishna and Indra might have had the following conversation," tells us Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. "Then Krishna would say, 'But Indra, how is it possible for my devotee to do something like this?'" Uh-oh. And Indra might have to reply, "Well, I became angry when my worship was stopped." And Krishna might reply, "Though I am your master and I stopped your worship, I cannot believe that my servant would do such a thing." Now recently, I've forgotten where it was, I think in a car going somewhere, and someone was making the comment that they couldn't understand why Indra reacted so badly. I mean, he could get a little angry, but look how far he went. So when I read this particular section, because I couldn't answer when this person was making this comment, I couldn't understand either, really, when you think about it, why did he get that angry? But Indra will say this. He says, "I can't believe that my servant would do such a thing. Why did you do it?" And Indra says, "Anything is possible for one who is falsely proud." So here is something for us. A very, very sobering point. Anything is possible. Then Krishna said, "Though pride may somehow arise in my devotee, he will remove it with his intelligence." So again, Indra bows his head and then he says, "But intense anger, tivra, Manyuna is the word for intense anger. He says, intense anger destroys all one's intelligence. So here's a very powerful little exchange for our practicing benefit, because we also have, as we talked about yesterday in class, we have this tendency to false pride. It's right there, as if sitting right beside us on our shoulder, or even inside our heart. And the anger is also not difficult to find. So the words of Indra, the humility that he's going to have to acknowledge and admit to, the humble position, it also is relevant for us. So then the next verse, text 13, continuing like this, Indra says, O Lord, you have shown mercy to me by shattering my false pride. Now, who would like to have your false pride shattered? Has anyone ever seen or experienced something like a windscreen shattering in a car accident, or seen something like that? Yeah, who would like to have their false pride shattered like that? There's not a lot of people who are brave enough to say, I would like you to shatter my false pride. Sometimes people stand up, you know, with a kind of a little bit brazen way and say, okay, try and shatter my false pride. But who? There's not a long queue of people waiting to have their false pride shattered. And neither Indra was in a queue of that kind. He was going on doing everything, absorbed in his position and his power. But now he's seeing that this was a very amazing thing that happened to him. Something that he wasn't really good for him, was removed in quite a shocking way. He says, you have shattered my false pride and defeated my attempt to punish Vrindavan. To you, the Supreme Lord, Spiritual Master, and Supreme Soul, I have now come for shelter. So let us read what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says about this. Indra has said, though I have caused great disturbance to Raj, I have received your mercy. Like a sick person being diagnosed and given medicine by a doctor. So this is again another way to look at it when something happens to us that's very heavy, and we incur some difficulty as a result of some experience, how to see this properly. Thus cured of my disease, I have given up the urge to release my lightning bolts. Because you control everything, you are the Supreme Lord. Because you give benefit to everyone, you are the Spiritual Master. Because you are the supreme object of love, you are the Supreme Soul. So in the next verse, thus glorified by Indra, Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, smiled and then spoke to him as follows in a voice resonant like the clouds. Now, Krishna is going to respond to him. We'll see what he says. So the little purport says, although in this past time Krishna appeared to be a small boy, the words mega gambiraya vacha indicate that he spoke to Indra with the deep, resonant voice of the Supreme Lord. He now did not speak to him as a little cowherd boy. He was going to respond to him in the same kind of majesty that Indra was possessed of himself. Tomorrow we will hear what Krishna responded. Indra has revealed his mind. He has taken this great step forward to come. He couldn't avoid it because, as some of the commentators say, after the punishment, the chastisement of the Samvantaka clouds by Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill, Indra developed a headache. He became very uncomfortable. He couldn't live with himself until he actually came and did this. So this is what he has, now we have heard his side, what he has said. Krishna will respond to him. It will be interesting for us to hear what he says, because perhaps sometimes we feel also we should seek the forgiveness of Krishna in some way or another, for something or another, And we would need to know, how will he respond? Is he going to himself take out a thunderbolt and say, so you did this to me, now it's my turn, and release a giant thunderbolt on Indra himself? What is his response? So I will stop here. If anyone has any questions in regards to Indra and his endeavors, we can speak on that. Yes, from.
Just as not finally, you said psychic cover on the body in the first.
Yes.
So can you explain that?
Yes. It says, the word Vishuddha Gyan Murtaya is most significant. Murti means the form of the deity. So here we have Murti. And it is specifically stated here that the Lord's form, he's the Murti, the Lord's form, is itself completely pure consciousness. This is an interesting presentation in this paragraph. So consciousness is the primary spiritual element. If you want to know what is a spiritual element, the primary one is consciousness. In other words, that means that there's no consciousness, no volition. What are other words that come from consciousness? As a result of consciousness, what is different between a person and an object? Inanimate means? Unconscious. But what are the characteristics of being inanimate as opposed to being animate or conscious? What's that? They have no free will. They can't. What does it mean to have free will?
Independence.
And what does it mean to have independence?
Right to choose.
The right to choose, exactly. Volition is the word that sometimes is used by the different writers on this subject. They have no volition. And the same thing applies in the beginning of this verse, where it's speaking about an it God has no volition either. Because an it is inanimate. Animate means male or female. Right? Consciousness means a human being. A human being is an animal, so many different species, but there's male, female, so many species. And so any kind of a living entity has some volition. That means that if you bring an animal in here and they see, they don't like it in here, they will choose to leave. They will try to leave. They will try to do something to protect themselves in a difficult situation so they can defend themselves in some way or another. But this microphone doesn't do that. And the table doesn't do that. It just sits here and it waits. It doesn't consciously wait. It's just here to be used. And you haven't yet seen, I'm sure, even in Melbourne Mandir, that the speaker's seat comes over and sits here by itself, ready to serve. It's being used in service. It's not itself choosing to serve. So these are any other points about consciousness, how consciousness is different from unconsciousness?
Presence of the spiritual spark.
Presence of the spiritual spark, how can you recognize that?
Like a dead body has no movement and a living
body. No movement. What else? It has no feelings. An inanimate doesn't have feelings, doesn't have.
No respiration.
No breathing is going on. And what else happens as a result of respiration? So, are you trying to say that this table can't grow and it can't produce little tables?
Yeah.
So, here. Yeah. So all of these things, the elements of our life that we just take as normal, we don't even think about them. Like, if you ask someone, would you like to take over control of your breathing? You want to be in control of everything. Would you like to manage your own breathing? Put it on manual so every day you can. No, all these things go on automatically. For there's consciousness there, and when the consciousness is extricated from that. unconscious mass, then even the dead body becomes as useless, as immobile and as inanimate as this. So it's a funny thing. It's like, if you want to think about it, if you put a glove on, if you have a beautiful glove, maybe I have a glove that's covered in sequins, and over here I have an old dirty glove from the ground, and I move my hand, and this glove can dance and do so many things, and this glove also can do whatever I want it to do. But if I take off the glove, neither of them, it's only a very superficial thing, this one's nicer than that one, but neither of them can dance or move. So then you see that it's almost an illusory, mystical thing, that now the dance of the glove, but now then the glove is flat and lifeless. So the body is like that. But because of the subtle nature of consciousness, it goes through every particle of the body is able to move around, and we feel that identification with the body. But it's very, very, very apparent to anyone who's seen a dead body that something radically different is here. There's no life there, and nor will there ever be again. So this consciousness is the primary spiritual element, distinct from any of the material elements, and even distinct from the subtle or psychological material elements. So the psychological material elements means the mundane mind, intelligence, and false ego, which are simply a psychic covering over pure consciousness. So one covering is subtle, and the Bhakti Vinod Thakur, he calls this Chaitanya Abhas. Chaitanya means consciousness, like Chaitanya Chaitamrita, and Abhas, like we know Namabhas, we're chanting, and it's not quite the holy name in its full developed form, but it's not either. It's the Achinta Bheda Abheda. It isn't and it is at the same time. So the subtle mind and body, the subtle mind and intelligence and the sense of identity, it's not material, but it's not spiritual, it's somewhere in the middle. So that's the psychic covering of a pure consciousness. But Krishna doesn't have a psychic covering like we do. Any other points?
How should we separate the false pride and the single identity which Krishna is speaking in the Bhagavad Gita, that we are all individual souls?
How do we separate the false pride
and that individuality that we have?
Well, if you say, how do we separate the false pride, generally if you say, how do I separate the good things from the bad things? So we sometimes think, how do I separate the false pride from the pride? Right? Generally if you say, separate false something, separating from the thing. But it's, how do we separate pride, not even false pride, how do we separate pride, not because pride itself is false, from our actual sense of identity? Is that what you want to know? We have to actually understand our sense of identity properly, because the false pride is the covering of ignorance, and we don't understand our identity properly. And as we begin to understand more clearly, this is a prerequisite for nishtha, strong spiritual steadiness, is to understand ourselves properly. So Bhagavad Gita is the primary study, like the ABC book. That means that from the ABCs, all the language after that comes. So the first part, place to begin, is with Bhagavad Gita and hear what Krishna himself says about our real identity. And then we can try to apply ourselves to thought on that subject. Then everything that follows after that is based on that understanding.
I will rephrase my question. Like, what is the difference between having pride and having individuality?
Having pride and having individuality?
What are the features of the
individuality? Individuality? The features of pride are that you always think you're better than others. The features of individuality are that you're aware that you in yourself have value. You have value, they have value, everyone has value. And so you don't have the tendency to put your value on top of theirs and push them down and push you up. So you can appreciate the features of individuality is that you can appreciate both your own characteristics and you can appreciate others' characteristics also. And the features of pride are that you've got a bit of a misconception about your own self-worth and you're putting yourself up above others. So the tendency to wish to be glorified is considered to be, for example, a characteristic of a person who's proud. But a person who's in actual individual consciousness, they can speak about their glories, but they speak about them because they're aspects of their existence has been part of Krishna, not about them being therefore highlighted above other people. Those are some points. Does anyone else want to suggest anything? What is the difference between individuality and pride?
Individuality, I think, is understanding everything in relation to Krishna.
In relation to Krishna.
And pride is something which is not related to Krishna. Thinking that it is out of our own thinking.
Yeah, not related to Krishna.
Individuality also involves personality.
Yes.
Particular personality.
There's a lot of brilliance in individuality. It's very nice. It's not like as if, because that's usually the misconception of people in general. If you think this body is me and this is my individuality, then it arises in the mind of somebody some fear when they see death, because death implies to them, I know who I am won't exist anymore. But if one understands one's individuality beyond their misconceived individuality of the present, which is the false pride, then you begin to realize that if I take off this, there's somebody else. Who is that? And that person doesn't have any unpleasant characteristics, as we might find to our dismay in our makeup of the present time. Any other?
In the spiritual world, is the soul the spiritual body, or does the soul accept
a soul? The soul is the spiritual body.
Is the spiritual.
Yeah.
So there's nothing, even though both of them are spiritual, there's nothing separate.
There's nothing separate. Yeah, that's what's different than here. Just like the word swabhav, it means one's identity. And swabhav, this word bhav, also means one's love. So our identity in the spiritual world is a composite of our love. It's not like we have one of these and we're separate from it. But the body is composed of our love. So therefore, what does that mean? That means there are different primary relationships given in Nectar of Devotion that we can have with Krishna. And the body is part of that relationship rather than here am I and I have on this spiritual body. It's a little bit difficult for our minds at the present to conceive of that, because when we search for a reference point, we don't find one here. Just like Srila Prabhupada says in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita, it's very difficult for a person here to understand something that has no cause. Because everything has a cause, that means a beginning. And when you hear that we're beginningless, there's nowhere to repose for getting some reference from our experience of life. So therefore, that is why there are certain things that at this point we can only hear about and accept them submissively. We can't actually understand them very deeply, and we can't necessarily even realize. We obviously can't realize them. But we hear these concepts given from personalities who are in realization of this, and then we have pure knowledge by that source.
It's like a soul body.
like a soul body.
I mean, like, say someone is a cow. That's them. That's their whole. That's them. They're a cow.
They're a cow.
Their identity.
Their body is composed of their love. They love in the pit. They love deeply and fully in a particular way, and it manifests as the beauty of their body to offer the service that they wish to offer. It's a little bit more advanced than where we are. Yeah.
But sometimes it describes the soul as like human life.
That's again to give a concept to us here in the material, whilst we're here in the material world, to have something you can't. In other words, if something is just too, can't understand it, so therefore you've got to find a reference point to help somebody to progress. But when we hear people say that, you know, I'll have a spiritual body, that's not actually quite correct. But, you know, just say something. So yes, that we also say that the soul is a 10,000 at the tip of the head of the hair. We've heard that so many times. So that's also correct. But that's the position of the soul within a body, within the material world. It's not the position. If that was all we were in the spiritual world, it's not appealing. And it isn't actually true. Yes.
One thing I have the tendency to put everything in the world in accordance with me, not with Krishna. So how to practice to...
Everyone has that. There's nobody who doesn't have that. A tendency to put... That's what's called trying to be the center of the universe. When I was listening to my husband speaking yesterday, speaking about how we want to be the center of the universe... And as I was listening, I was thinking, well, I don't want to be the center of the universe. It's obvious that I can't be the center of the universe. But then when he reduced it down to a little small box, and you could be the center of your universe in there, then I could. That was what was on my mind. Of course, yes, I do have my little domain, though, and in there, no one should cross over my path. So that's actually, as soon as you're embodied, as a soul is embodied in a body, it's like you could say if you put something in a capsule and you have another capsule and another capsule. So you're encapsulated within a gross and subtle body. So within there, you conceive of everything and you're in the center. And everyone has that. Unless they actually become elevated enough to understand that this gross and subtle body is something like wearing clothes, as we hear in Bhagavad Gita, and they no longer identify with their clothes, that state of elevation, then that false sense of I, and therefore also mine, it can be removed, it's removable then. But we all have that, so how do we deal with that? Is that your question? So that's where the process of Krishna consciousness comes in. And the first way, if we're going to say that we're souls and what does it mean to be a soul, is very simply, and throughout all of Srila Prabhupada's teachings, he says, you try to think, I'm a servant, a servant, a servant. I'm a servant of Guru, I'm a servant of Krishna. And that is the first conceptual change. Instead of I'm the center of everything, I'm a servant. And that's a big one. And then as that matures further and further and deeper and deeper and deeper, greater understanding comes of that position, then further things are, doors are opened for one to enter into in the mood of a servant. But as soon as that's not there, or if we're not pursuing that, we're in the material consciousness, because we'll be thinking in the other way, going towards the master idea, not the servant idea. That's the first thing that has to be taken advantage of to make that change.
How to practice for Krishna and then?
There's a whole process. Sometimes when people ask a question like that, somewhere, I'm not saying yourself, but I would say for myself, at different times when I ask that question, what I'm really sort of asking is, I wish it would hurry up. It doesn't seem to be working quickly enough. I've heard it, I know the answer intellectually, but I wish it would actually start taking effect quickly, ideally immediately. But it does take some time for that, for the application to make this huge change. Look at the change that you're asking for. You're going 100 miles an hour that way, and then somebody's telling you you should be going 100 miles an hour that way. You've got to have an arc, right, to change. In a car, you can't just turn, go this way. You have to go round, 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 and you go on the freeway, right, and then go on the other way. Right? There's a big circle that you take, and then you can go the other way. So here we are, we're in that, you know, going the, making that change, shift, to turn from north to south. So if we say, well, you know, why is, it doesn't seem to be working, then just stay on the road, it will work. This is what we will discover, it will work, but it's, there's a bit of an arc has to be traversed to get there. So a little bit of encouragement and a little bit of patience helps. Yes,
an injury was causing all the disturbance to the residents of Vrindavan. What if Krishna just removing from this position, someone else said it, instead of like, I understand it's fine for everything you have now, but it seems like he creates these positions and he should fulfill them. Does he prefer to leave someone in there to reform and grow? Or?
Well, Indra's position is a very, very substantial one. And he's earned that position in the universal affairs, so to speak. Just like when Bali Maharaj tried to take over Indra's position, and we heard that he performed many pious activities to try to get up his, you know, his qualification, but he wasn't able to keep the position. And later on, Vamanadeva said to him, in the next millennium, you can be Indra. So the position is kind of an extremely primary one in the government. It's not a voted for government. It's a very exalted position. Indra's position. So it would hardly seem appropriate for everyone in general to in a very cultured society, if someone is acting amiss, the first thing that is done is you take them aside and you speak to them. You don't make a public, you know, as we would in our uncultured society. You pull something down and put something up and pull that down. And this is the structure of the whole universe. So, first of all, Krishna is thinking, Indra has this pride, so how can this be removed, rather than how can Indra be removed? But Indra was fearing that maybe he's going to remove me. But Krishna prefers to remove the pride than to remove the devotee. Because there is affection. As we're here, Krishna has affection for us. You may think, why would he have affection for me? And that's probably because when I feel like that, I often think it's because I don't have much affection for him. I think, why has he got affection for me? And as one has affection for somebody, you just assume they have affection for you because you're so affectionate to them. So Indra at this point hasn't acted affectionately, so he's feeling that maybe something is going to happen that will get in the way of his self-interest. So he's self-interested. But Krishna has affection for him, and he will show it. And part of his removal of his pride was to ignore him. You know, when a child is misbehaving, it's a teaching technique that you don't give any attention to their bad behavior and you give a lot of attention to their good behavior, and then they understand which one is being reinforced. So he just ignored him, and that was actually why he became inflamed. And it all came out. And then now Krishna will speak to him further on what he should and shouldn't do. Is that alright? Yes.
Mataji, we see that in Vrindavan, in Boma Vrindavan, we see that Krishna is born, Prabhupada's voice are born, and they grow up, and then they also become old sometimes. So is it that when we go back to God, the spiritual body undergoes change in the sense that we have birth, old age and all, but it's not in relation to the material world. It's not degenerated according to time, but it is.
Well, it's a little bit inconceivable. Let's take, for example, somebody like Narada Muni, who has a spiritual body. Yeah. So Narada Muni is always Narada Muni, right? He goes here and there, he takes part in so many places. He goes to Dwarka and he goes into all the palaces of Krishna. He can go to them all at the same time. So he can expand himself also into 16,000 different places at the same time. And yet also in the Srimad Bhagavatam, you hear how Narada was born, he was a little boy, and how he became perfect. But we also know that Narada was always there. Or Nanda Maharaj, here we hear how he performed austerities and then he became, in his next life, he got this position as Krishna's father. But we hear also how Nanda Maharaj is always there. So there are two different, you could say almost like stratas on which Krishna's pastimes or these leaders take place. One is within the material world, when they manifest within the material world, and the other one is in the spiritual world. And so they it's as if they take place slightly differently in both, but there is no contradiction and no impurity. So in the spiritual world, there is no past, present and future, so Krishna is always at a particular age and enjoying these pastimes. And this is such an inconceivable subject that in the Rama Samhita and also other places, the acharyas, the Goswamis, are our primary acharyas, Jiva Goswami and other acharyas, they say don't argue on this subject. Don't say, well, I think, because it's too inconceivable. But a primary source that we can trust to read from is Brihad Bhagavatamrita by Sanatan Goswami. And he describes there, through the words of this young cowherd boy, that sometimes I stay there in the spiritual world, where everything is always ever-present time, and sometimes I come down to the material world, where Krishna is a baby born, grows, He says, both of these places I see as the same. And sometimes I'm here and sometimes I'm there, but I never look at anything as I'm going between there and there. I don't let my consciousness go anywhere, but I'm going there and coming back. I don't touch matter, in other words. So Krishna can appear and the boys can appear as babies and grow up, but in material, on the material worlds, pastimes, and in the spiritual world, they're eternally like that. So both are there. And it's not other than for Krishna's pastimes that there are these transformations, and of course also for the benefit of people in the material world, to bring them up so they can also enter into these pastimes. It's a mysterious subject matter, but it's a valuable one to consider. Any other points?
Manji, we always try to think of the pastimes which Krishna has given us in the earthly planet. And even before his presence in the his birth in the material world, he was existing and everybody was knowing that. So why don't they even focus on the...
Because they're more and more and more inconceivable to us. So the Bhagavatam is manifest by the mercy of Vyasadeva, so that we have some subject matter, and that's inconceivable to us. So how would we like to go deeper and deeper into what we can't possibly understand with our, as Prabhupada would use the word, blunt material senses? So something is spoken. There are literatures that speak something, but they speak it in the way of explaining it rather than allowing you to enter it. That's one answer. And the other answer is that it is not something to be understood with your intelligence. It's something that as you become purer, as we become purer, it's something we realize from within. It's not transferable information. It's transferable through heart to heart. It's not transferable through mouth to mouth. So some acharyas will speak something, but the words are not always to be understood. Even Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, he's thinking, I want to speak of the very confidential pastimes, but then I'm thinking people may misuse this subject matter, and then he says, But then when I realize that no one can understand it, ironically, then he says, when I can see that no one can understand it unless they're capable of understanding it, then I speak freely. Because one has to be capable of understanding the subject matter, even if it was spoken. So we start with what we've got, and we start working with what we've got, and then we can build up our ability. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai. Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki Jai. Gopinath, Hari Hari Bol.